can find themselves in a position of not being able to heat or light their homes.
It's been this way forever. I used to be a unionist. I saw the crisis coming. This is how our country works. We don't have any sovereignty.
Nothing works in this country. We have forever been in the hands of a bunch of swindlers and criminals. Italy has no future.
The outgoing government is planning to offset its dependence on Russian gas by signing new deals with African and Eastern Mediterranean countries and building new regasification plants in a number of Italian sea towns, a move that has met with staunch opposition from local residents. Max Civili, Rome.
Rights groups have accused the Israeli regime of committing war crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip during its three-day onslaught against the territory. On Friday, Israeli forces started launching wanton attacks on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of civilians, including women and children. The fighting stopped on Sunday through an Egypt-mediated ceasefire. But Palestinians now have to live with the devastating aftermath of Israeli attacks. According to Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians were systematic and deliberate and fall under Israel's strategy of using disproportionate and excessive force against civilians.
Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights reiterates its strongest condemnation of Israel's gross and systematic violations of international law, particularly in cases of extrajudicial killings and attacks against civilians and civilian objects. Such violations amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity for which those responsible must be held accountable.
Five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008. The regime has been using U.S.-made warplanes and weapons to hit targets in the densely populated area.
The United States and Israel are both responsible for the bloodshed in Gaza. Israel was given the green light from the United States to carry out the brutal attacks on Gaza under the watchful eye of the international community. Israel and the United States are partners in crime against the Palestinian people.
Human rights organizations say, based on the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, it is more than clear that Israel has been committing war crimes during its attacks on Gaza.
The impunity Israel continues to enjoy and the absence of accountability encourage Israeli officials to continue perpetuating war crimes against Palestinians. As evidenced by its latest aggression on Gaza, Israel does not hesitate to engage in prohibited acts of killing, including direct targeting of civilians. The International Criminal Court must at least investigate these crimes.
For decades now, there has been no pressure on Israel to stop its violence against civilians. Despite repeated and desperate pleas from human rights groups, the international community has stayed silent about the regime's atrocities against Palestinians.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinians continue to suffer due to international apathy. Now, rights groups are demanding that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Tragedy, injustice and destruction prompted a group of London rights organizations to call an emergency demonstration in support of Palestine and Palestinians. The Israeli bombardment of Gaza was the worst it's been since the May 2021 war that killed 260 Palestinians and destroyed thousands of homes and businesses. This new assault cost the lives of at least 47 Palestinians. A third of the scores killed were children. For those attending the demonstration opposite Downing Street, the official residence of the British Prime Minister, they needed to be present to raise their voice against the injustice.
What we've witnessed over the last few days is very familiar, but no less horrific. Once again, Israel has been bombing the Palestinian people in Gaza, claiming a right to self-defense. There's a reality here. that any form of violence that is used to enforce occupation, used to enforce apartheid, used to enforce settler colonialism is by definition illegitimate. It is the Palestinian people who have a right to defence and to protect themselves.
One of the main themes linking the speakers at this event is the fact that the Israeli aggression is only made possible by the tacit support of states like the British, and that Palestinian blood remains on British hands.
The UK has obligations under international humanitarian law and the Geneva Convention to look after the people who are occupied rather than stand with the oppressor, with the world's 21st century apartheid state. They must stop. They must support the Palestinians in real terms, not through words, two-state solution, which means absolutely nothing, but in sanctioning Israel, because that's the next thing that needs to happen.
Your policy on the Palestinians has to change. Justice has to prevail. And the way the hypocrisy, the way they do deal with the Palestinian issue and other issues like the Ukrainian issues, for example, is at least we can say a hypocritical way of dealing with it. Therefore, we are here today to raise our voice and tell them that this is not acceptable.
Though a ceasefire is supposed to be in force, commentators point out that this simply means Israel has moved its campaign of aggression to other parts of occupied Palestine, including Nablus, where there have already been casualties, raising the specter of an escalation resulting in further Palestinian blood being shed. Amina Taylor, London.
Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference on the dire situation of Yemeni children amid the years-long Saudi war on the country. The ministry has criticized the United Nations for its inaction on Saudi atrocities.
When the United Nations removed Saudi Arabia from the list of violators of children's rights, it encouraged the kingdom to continue killing Yemeni children and targeting service facilities for children such as schools, hospitals and health centers. It also prevented the entry of humanitarian and medical aid for children. We know that there are UN reports that talk about the spread of malnutrition amongst children, along with many chronic diseases that need care. But unfortunately, there is no real action to save the children of Yemen.
Officials say the UN has collaborated with the Saudi-led coalition in killing Yemeni children by providing political cover-up for Riyadh's violations. Moreover, the world body removed the kingdom from the list of groups accused of violating children's rights.
The United Nations is a clear and prominent partner in the aggressive war on Yemen, and we have in the 8 years of war clear evidence that the United Nations participated in all the crimes committed against the Yemenis and did not condemn Saudi Arabia for its crimes, but rather the victims bear everything the executioner does. The United Nations has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children through its silence and coverage of Saudi crimes. It has also removed Saudi Arabia 5 times from the list of violators of children's rights.
According to human rights groups, more than 9,000 children have been killed or maimed by Saudi airstrikes since the beginning of the war in 2015. Health officials say more than 1 million children are suffering from malnutrition, one of the highest numbers in the world.
Human rights activists say the United Nations is hostage to Saudi Arabia's funding for its programs. They say the world body has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children because of its silence on Saudi crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Israeli forces have assassinated Ibrahim al-Nablusi, a resistance fighter and commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops raided Nablus early Tuesday and surrounded a building in the old city where al-Nablusi had barricaded himself in. A gunfight lasted for several hours with Israeli forces even firing anti-tank missiles at the building. 32-year-old Islam Sabouh and 16-year-old teen Hossein Jamal Taha were also killed in the raid. At least 60 Palestinians were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We have not witnessed such an aggressive raid to Nablus in years. The aim was to assassinate al-Nablusi and any other Palestinian who was assisting him. He refused to surrender and clashed with the soldiers for hours and was finally martyred.
As the raid started, we rushed to the old town, but the soldiers had blocked the neighborhood. They opened fire at us. We tried to evacuate the wounded, including a woman. But they continued shooting at us. Dozens were wounded as a result.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reacted to Nablus operation, saying that the killing of whom he described as terrorist Ibrahim Nabulsi was another step in Israel's uncompromising fight against terrorism.
This cell has been worrying Israeli military. They carried out a number of shootings against Israeli soldiers and settlers. That is why the Israeli military wanted to strike them and kill one of its leaders.
A number of West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Al-Khalil, observed commercial strikes as part of a period of mourning and in protest at the killings in Nablus. The regime forces clashed with the protesters in Al-Khalil and shot dead at least one Palestinian. It has become clear that Israel is targeting any Palestinian who is honored as a real fighter. The regime might succeed in assassinating those fighters like Ibrahim al-Nabulsi, but they would even be remembered as heroes and icons who devoted their lives to fighting Israeli soldiers. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
We never cease to support our Palestinian brothers and sisters. Why are the world rights entities keeping mum while Israel continues to kill innocent people in Gaza?
Tensions have escalated between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Friday, when Israel carried out airstrikes on cities across the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, killing dozens of people, including two commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. The Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, responded by firing hundreds of rockets towards Israel, putting the Israeli forces on the back foot. Activists here say the Islamic Jihad's show of force has pushed Tel Aviv into calling for a ceasefire, which took effect on Sunday.
In the past, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians would go unanswered. But today, as soon as Israel carries out a strike, the resistance responds immediately with its rockets. So, the era of hit and run is over.
The conflict is the worst outbreak of violence between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Operation Sword Al-Quds, an 11-day war last May. The UN Security Council has expressed deep concern over the situation in the Gaza Strip during an emergency meeting held on Tuesday to discuss the Israeli aggression on the besieged territory.
While the UN has expressed its concern over the escalating violence against Palestinians, activists here say this is not enough. They called on the international body to stop paying lip service and take action to keep Israel from further violation of security in the occupied Palestinian territories. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemenis from all walks of life flocked to the street of Yemen's capital Sana'a to commemorate the third Imam of Shia Muslims, Imam Hussein. He was martyred on Ashura, the 10th day of the lunar month of Muharram.
We went out as Yemenis to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, who inspired patience and steadfastness in us in the face of the forces of global arrogance. We are in a battle with thousands of people like Yazid and even worse than him, including America and Israel. They attacked the Yemenis people and the Palestinian people. They are still killing our women and children. So this memory gives us hope that the values we learned from Imam Hussein will make us live generously and win at the end of the battle.
Imam Hussein, protesters said, is still alive because of his immortalized values and beliefs, which reject the oppression and corruption that Yemenis are currently experiencing. They further said Imam Hussein was the symbol of revolution and tenacity, who motivated Yemenis to resist the Saudi-led attack on their country.
This day is very important to us as we consider Ashura part of our identity. We are with Imam Hussein with our souls. Ashura this year coincides with the battle with the Zionist enemy, so the nation will follow the path of Imam Hussein in his jihad until the liberation of all occupied lands, especially occupied Al-Quds, and Yemen has come a long way towards freedom and independence.
After refusing to pledge alliance to the tyrant of that day, Yazid, in 680 AD, Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions and family members were killed during the Battle of Karbala.
People, he believed that Yemen has become a modern-day Karbala, with the Saudi-led coalition killing people, displacing civilians, and enforcing a siege on the country. People, he are confident that Yemen's fight against the enemy will ultimately lead to victory. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
in the limelight.
For a septuagenarian lawmakers who wrote the historic climate bill that Congress passed on Friday, 12th of August, and a 79-year-old president who is about to sign it into law, the measure represents a once-in-a-generation victory. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Lisa Friedman and Coral Davenport. The piece is titled, As Historic Climate Bill Heads to Biden's Desk, Young Activists Demand More. For the septuagenarian lawmakers who wrote the historic climate bill that Congress passed on Friday, 12th of August, and a 79-year-old president who is about to sign it into law, the measure represents a once-in-a-generation victory. But younger Democrats and climate activists crave more. They look at the bill as a down payment, and they worry a complacent electorate will believe Washington has at least solved climate change, when in fact scientists warn it has only taken the first necessary steps. This bill is not the bill that my generation deserves and needs to fully avert climate catastrophe, but it is the one that we can pass given how much power we have at this moment, said Varshini Prakash, a 29-year-old who co-founded the Sunrise Movement, a youth-led climate activism group. Christina Zintzun Ramirez, a 40-year-old president of Next Gen America, which is focused on young voter participation, said it wasn't lost on her that the climate deal was crafted largely by older men and included some concessions to the fossil fuel industry. We are very clear that it took so long because our Congress and our Senate doesn't look like the American people, said Ms. Ramirez, whose group is working to elect more young progressives committed to attacking global warming. The climate crisis is going to unfold on the majority of young people. Most of these congressional representatives will be dead by the time we face the consequences of their actions or of their inaction. In a letter to members of Congress, Ms. Ramirez and about 50 other young leaders told lawmakers, "Your work is not finished." The House of Representatives voted 220-207 on Friday, 12th of August, to approve the Inflation Reduction Act, with Democrats pushing past united Republican opposition. It was a replay of earlier this week, when Democrats in the Senate passed the bill without a single Republican vote. The legislation provides $370 billion over a decade for investments in wind, solar, and clean hydrogen, energy storage, and other measures designed to shift the American economy away from fossil fuels that have underpinned it for more than a century. Analysts estimate that the new law will draw down the United States' carbon dioxide emissions to the lowest level since Lyndon B. Johnson was president, 20% below 2005 levels by the end of this decade, on top of another 20% cut that will come as a result of market forces already in place. Together, that would eliminate an estimated 1 billion tons of pollution per year by the end of 2030, almost enough to meet Joe Biden's pledge to cut emissions 50% by 2030. Senator Patrick Leahy, an 82-year-old Democrat of Vermont, praised the legislation when it passed the Senate as a once-in-a-generation bill to meaningfully address the real threats of climate change, a characterization echoed by several of his colleagues. But scientists are saying the United States needs to do a lot more. It must stop adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by 2050, which the bill won't achieve. That is the target all major economies must meet to constrain average global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels, according to scientists. Beyond that threshold, the likelihood increases significantly of catastrophic droughts, catastrophic floods, wildfires, and heat waves. The planet has already warmed an average of about 1.1 degrees Celsius. It's like losing 20 pounds when you need to lose 100 pounds, said Robert McNally, the president of Rapidan Energy Group, an energy consulting firm. Robert McNally added, and this won't get you there. After the champagne is drunk, there will be a moment of sobriety, he said. How do you close the rest of that gap? To reach his 2030 goal, President Biden would still have to impose new regulations on emissions from power plants, vehicle tailpipes, and methane leaks from oil and gas wells. State and local governments would have to set new standards to compel the rapid adoption of electric cars, wind and solar-powered electricity, and energy-efficient buildings to make up the last percentage points. With a far heavier lift, essentially eliminating the nation's fossil fuel emissions in the next two decades, Congress would need to enact even more ambitious legislation than the historic bill just passed by a razor-thin majority, according to experts. To zero out emissions by 2050, Congress would have to take on politically difficult burden of taxing, penalizing, banning, or phasing out the coal, oil, and gas pollution that is driving global warming. It will be necessary for Congress to put sticks in place, said Dallas Bertrow, an energy policy expert at Resources for the Future, a nonpartisan energy and environmental research organization based in Washington, D.C. The new law buys Congress some time to act, Dallas Bertrow said. It doesn't need to happen today or tomorrow or this year or next year, he said, but it does have to happen before the end of this decade. Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington, a 56-year-old who leads the House Progressives Caucus, said in addition to deeper cuts in emissions, young and racially diverse climate advocates want new provisions that also protect low-income neighborhoods and communities of color, which are disproportionately affected by climate impacts. They're really talking about it from this integrated perspective of jobs, justice, and decarbonization, she said. Representative Sean Caston, Democrat of Illinois and a scientist who owned a clean energy company, said Democrats and activists deserve an end zone dance after the bill is signed and then must get back to work. In the near term, Congress will have to make it easier to build the transmission lines and other facilities needed to allow the explosion of solar, wind, and other renewable energy promised by the new law, he said. Sean Caston, a 50-year-old, also wants Congress to eliminate tax breaks and other subsidies granted to the oil, gas, and coal industries, a move, he said, will trigger markets to correctly allocate capital to clean energy industries. We have to be, as legislators, very clear-eyed that we are not going to be judged on whether we voted yes or no on this bill, he said. We're going to be judged on whether the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is lower or higher 10 years from now. Even as scientific evidence links climate change to extreme weather events that is causing death and destruction in the United States, opinion polls show that the American electorate is divided along partisan lines about the scale of the problem and what to do about it. A Pew survey published in July found a majority of Republicans and independents who lean Republican, about 82%, say Joe Biden's climate policies are hurting the country, while 79% of Democrats and those who lean to the left were broadly supportive of Biden's policies. But Republicans between the ages of 18 and 29 surveyed were more likely than older adults to say the federal government needs to act on climate change, and 64% wanted the government to require power companies to use more energy from renewable sources. And younger Americans of both political parties, those born after 1981, are more likely to be politically engaged on climate change than older generations, according to a 2021 Pew survey. Celinda Lake, a Democratic strategist, said she believes the political support for a carbon tax could grow, particularly as Millennial and Generation Z voters entered office. In 2024, the Millennials and younger generations will outnumber the Boomer voters, Celinda Lake said. She added, "These are the voters who vote on this issue. It mobilizes them. In the next 20 years, we will see a massive shift in the electorate towards people who want to save the planet." Wisconsin State Representative Greta Neubauer, a 30-year-old, led the rollout of a package of 22 climate bills this year, five of which she wrote. None received a hearing in the Republican-led legislature, much less a vote. But Ms. Neubauer said she still finds the number of former activists like herself now turning to politics encouraging. "When Donald Trump was elected, we all had to look around and recognize the failures of our movement," said Ms. Neubauer, who ran on a climate platform and was elected in 2017. Many of her fellow former activists have recently joined political campaigns or considered running for office themselves, to take the fight off college campuses, she said. William Riley, who served as head of Environmental Protection Agency under President George H.W. Bush, said Democrats will be lucky to just maintain the new provisions that just barely got through the Congress. "As long as you've got a unanimous Republican position against it, they're going to have to fight just to keep what they've got in place," William Riley said. "They have to fight to keep the clean energy incentives, fight to keep any regulations, and Republicans will try to claw it back unless at some point enough Republicans feel that they are politically free to convert." Benji Becker, a 24-year-old founder of American Conservation Coalition, a conservative climate action group, said if Republicans retake either the House or Senate in November's midterm elections, he wants party leaders to address climate change. He noted that climate and tax bill includes incentives for nuclear power and other Republican priorities, including carbon capture technology that could allow coal or gas-burning power plants to keep operating with lower carbon emissions. Republicans can either go after that in the next Congress and champion the first-ever bipartisan climate bill, or they can stay where they've been for the last decade, Mr. Backer said. "My generation will be disappointed if they don't lead from the front." Rihanna Gunn-Wright, a 32-year-old director of climate policy at the Roosevelt Institute, a liberal think tank and an architect of the Green New Deal, said she is worried a sense of complacency will settle in after passage of this climate bill. "Over the next 7 or 8 years, there will still, unfortunately, be extreme weather events, and we'll still need to keep pointing out the cause of those events, carbon dioxide emissions. And from where? From fossil fuels," she said. Ms. Gunn-Wright said she knows activists who fought for decades to see a president sign major climate legislation will be tired. But she cautioned, in the United States, we have a history of taking a lot of first steps and then not taking the second step, the third or the fourth step.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Britain's economy is faltering amid a cost-of-living crisis and the highest inflation it's seen in decades. The economy contracted by 0.1% in the 3 months to June, with a recession predicted for the end of the year. The Office for National Statistics blames the contraction on a fall in services output. Last week, the Bank of England said it expects the economy to enter recession in the fourth quarter. The recession would be the largest since the 2008 financial crisis. And just recently, the Bank of England raised interest rates by the biggest margin in nearly three decades to ride out inflation mainly caused by soaring energy and fuel prices. We'll try to find out the reasons for this downward spiral on tonight's Spotlight. Joining us for the program, we have economic analyst Shabir Rezvi joining us from London. And we also have Mahmoud Refat, president of the European Institute for International Law, who's with us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines. featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Razvi in London, Britain. As we've reported now, on the brink of recession, official figures show the country's economy contracted in the second quarter of this year. Did this news come as a surprise to you, and what do you see as the underlying causes for this contraction?
Hello, good evening. Look, the UK economy, obviously, at one level, has contracted, as you quite rightly pointed out. And in the sort of economic analysis of all economies that say that a second quarter dip in growth will be a recession, technically. But as we know, recently in the USA, similar situation happened, and the Reserve Bank, Mr. Biden, and all of them started coming out saying that really it's not a recession. So maybe the language will also change in UK, whereby the definition of a recession may also come on the agenda. That's one issue on a sort of a theoretical level, if you like. But what's really sort of hurtful and is really paining the mass of the public here is the cost of living crisis, fuel sort of prices going up. Recently, only a few days ago, it was announced that the average fuel cost is likely to be over £4,000 a year. That is almost double what people were saying paying almost a year ago, and likely to go up again in October, perhaps January in 2023 as well. So there are a whole host of issues that are going on and are having an impact on the economy. People's wages and salaries have not increased at all over the last 12 years since the Tory government has been in power. An interesting point to note is that only 11 years ago, this month, actually perhaps on 11th of August 2011, we had riots in UK, London, Birmingham, Manchester, all the major cities experienced huge riots. So I don't know if people are pushed in such a direction where by in winter, when they will have no choice whether to heat their homes or to sort of forego food that they need to buy. So that may push people to take to the streets and have demonstrations. So it's quite and I'm not trying to portray it as a dramatic situation that may happen, but the reality is that public servants, whether they're doctors, nurses, only today I was talking to one of the doctors and he said that effectively his own salary hasn't increased because the 2-3% increases that they have been receiving over the last 10 years, but inflation has eaten away all of it. And in fact, in real terms, their income has gone down. So that's a medical profession. So if you look at others who are on salaries of 25, 30, 35,000 pounds, your nurses, your policemen, your firefighters, and all the other public servants who don't earn huge amounts of income, they will see their a huge drop in their income due to inflation. And inflation is really being fueled by energy cost, increase in the mortgage payments. People have personal loans or credit cards. The interest being charged on that is around 30-40%. And people don't have enough income, so they're tending to rely on credit cards and other expensive methods of borrowing money, which just to pay their bills.
All right, let's bring in Mr. Rafat on the discussion as well. Mr. Rafat, how much of this that we're seeing right now in the UK is due to the consequences of the Ukraine war? Many blame the UK's economic woes primarily on the situation in Ukraine. Do you see it in that light as well?
Yes, for sure. The Ukraine war. But let me say or treat this topic from another dimension. In my opinion, the Ukraine war impacted UK on double edges, not only as the war. Yes, the war as war and the atmosphere of war, for sure, that to increase prices, especially to exploit inflation, to make lots of economic or to increase lots of economic negative points. But what happened with UK in particular, somehow we see it in the rest of Europe, but in particular in UK, what we can find, we find double edge. The inside UK, because UK seized lots of capitals and lots of assets of people without any legal base, basically. It's just administrative decisions. Lots of Russian businessmen, lots of Russian people, their assets and their properties were taken or seized at least and put under seizure by administrative decisions from British authorities. And that encouraged lots of other businessmen, especially from Gulf countries, either to transfer their money and their properties values, to put their properties value to for sale and to remove what they have as liquid. So that impacted inside this point. On the other point, which United States made to all Europe, is the increase of benefit on dollar when the American Federal Bank decided to increase the benefit interest. We know very well, once the Federal of United States increases the benefit on the American dollar, we know very well lots of capitals and lots of liquid go automatically there, as it's the most trusted economy over the world. So that made a big problem for both, for the British currency, the pound, and also to the euro. But on UK particularly, who is playing, let's say, and let me call it, which I estimate its role in this war, is the office boy of United States, because, which is very surprising, Americans' side, who are leading the war against Russia, practically, they did not behave like British authorities behaved. They did not put any seizure on properties by administrative decisions like British made. They did not follow Russian businessmen everywhere like British made, which is very surprising. That's why they are playing or they are taking this war on behalf of American side, but on their own edge. That which impacted UK and that which caused directly the price increase, which UK has been witnessing for the last 4 or 5 months, which prices increased dramatically in all essential goods and services, the inflation, the employment percentage got increased. Also, all that because of Ukraine war, principally, yes, but because the United States of America pushed things to that more and more and did not consider the interest of its allies when they increased the benefit through the Federal Bank.
Back to London with Mr. Razoui. We're going to use the B word here. Brexit. Is Britain still seeing the ripple effects of leaving the Union, and is there still more to come from that divorce?
Well, look, some people would say that Brexit has been brilliant for UK, because some people argue that we are a sovereign state, we can make our own decisions, and all kinds of other posturings that were sold to us at the time of coming out of the European Union. Of course, it has had a dramatic impact. People simply just visiting Europe from UK have to wait in different queues. It takes, instead of sort of just flying through immigration, it takes maybe 2 hours for them to pass through immigration. Then, of course, documentation on import-export, all these things have to be factored in. But I think what one has got to remember that Brexit may be one aspect of the challenges and the problems that the British economy is facing. But really, the last 12 years of austerity measures, which have been applied ideologically by this government, Tory government, which has been in power for the last 12 years, they have applied austerity measures in such a manner that effectively the poorer sections of the community have lost out, and we have our own multimillionaire oligarchs in UK who siphon off money from UK to offshore places, you know, have their companies located in Cayman Island or Belize or Bermuda or wherever. So all that kind of sort of shenanigans that are sort of used by the rich and wealthy in UK also has an impact. And of course, just to sort of comment on what our colleague was talking about, the Ukraine impact, if you like, you know, quite often Iran is often blamed by forces that are against Iran, saying that Iran is not spending its money on its own people and is supporting, you know, activities in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, and so on. We, the British government, the European nations, they're spending billions and billions on the war in Ukraine, and is being sold to us as a fight against a demonic power in Moscow. But that money should be used in our country, if you like, to ease the pressure on ordinary people so that salaries can be increased, so that more employment can be created in UK. But the reality is that we have taken this option of supporting the war in Ukraine and not really looking after our own people in the United Kingdom and in the European. And this will have a far-reaching impact, because cost of war can be seen in the short and medium term, but also in the long term, it has a huge impact, and that we haven't sort of seen as yet. The other point is that the austerity measures were one thing. The second was, of course, the corona casualty caused commercial crash in the UK and all over the world. For the last 2 years, before the economies started opening up, we had lockdowns. That had an impact. So all things are not really converging at this moment to benefit the UK economy.
Mr. Rafat, how does this data play into the Conservative leadership's contest?
Sorry, would you say that again, please?
How does this data regarding the contraction of the UK government play into the Conservative leadership's ongoing contest right now?
Well, I think it's playing a role in the not only on the Conservative leadership, but on all UK politician scene, in my opinion, and that we could see it in the kind of people were advanced or were pushed to be prime minister. We will find lots of them, the political party. Pushed majority of them are basically, principally, used to be businessmen or businesswomen. I mean, coming from the world of business, not coming from the real political school, as it's the habit for long decades now, or coming from strategic backgrounds, military or political, as we are getting used to since more than five, six decades. Since the end of the Second World War, we saw lots of faces who are coming from business world. That means the political atmosphere and the political class inside United Kingdom are convinced and very, very aware they are in a deep crisis. Not crisis, but they are on edge of crisis and they are in a deep problem. This problem will not be done, will not be ended just by some decisions to be taken, because the actions and the acts of United Kingdom and behaviors of United Kingdom toward Ukraine and or toward Russia concerning the war of Ukraine really will impact the British economy for decades. These Russian businessmen who had millions in UK, not only millions, but billions, who are employing people, who have lots of properties they pay taxes on, and they pay taxes on their capitals, and they pay taxes on their interest, etc., and they recruit services as well. All these people, I doubt they would come back soon to UK. They need real time, very long time to come back. So UK, last 5-6 months, acted very rapidly against them, and while was in rush, it took strong decisions. I estimate these decisions are wrong and illegal decisions, especially the seizure of properties and money of people without any judicial decisions. That was real catastrophe. That to impact a lot the investment atmosphere in any country, and doesn't encourage people to come back.
Okay.
So the politicians in the United Kingdom are aware of what I'm saying, and not only aware, they are convinced now they shoot their feet somehow.
Sure.
That's why they are trying now to find a medication for that through a decision maker and rising leadership coming from business background.
All right, we're short of time now. One last question for Mr. Razvi. Whoever wins the race for prime minister in September will have a whole lot to deal with, from rising food prices to energy shortages. The question is, when a new prime minister comes, will there be enough time to avert this looming recession? Yes or no?
Well, look, at the end of the day, there's no silver bullet to resolve the complex matters of the economy. Whether it's terse or... Mr. Sunak wins. It's interesting that one of the Conservative politicians described Mrs. Truss as bright as a 3-watt bulb. So it would be interesting to get her as the Prime Minister, who doesn't have enough sort of intellectual capacity to be able to fathom the problems of the economy and take it on a right course. But I think what we really have to remember is that our colleague said that Europe and Britain has shot itself in the foot. But the reality is that, as Mr. Orbán of Hungary said, that with the Ukraine war with and Russia, Europe has really shot itself in the lungs. So it's in a very critical situation, if you like. And we'll have to just see how time will tell the difficulties and the challenges that UK and the European Union are facing on the economic front.
Well, sorry to cut you off there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's program. And allow me to thank my guest, economic analyst Shebi Razvi, joining us from London. And also thanks to Mahmoud Refat, president of the European Institute for International Law, joining us from Stockholm.